Okay, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut, the co-founder of Torn Motion, which is based in Toronto. And I'd like to welcome you to another Torn Motion panel discussion, this time taking place at the Hill House of the University of Pennsylvania. I'd like to thank, first of all, from UPenn, Jacob Shamash and Rebecca Klar and David Svi Kalman, shout out for them. And they did really hard work in facilitating this program. The program is co-sponsored by Dr. Joel Hecker and Dr. Franny Pollack in memory of Harvey Hecker, Zell. I had the privilege of teaching Harvey on a weekly basis for 16 years. He was a man of great wisdom and integrity, and he was a passionate believer in the Jewish people, and he had a commitment to Jewish continuity and the well-being of all Jews, and may his memory be for a blessing. It's my pleasure to introduce our two panelists for this discussion. On my right, Rabbi Shmuel Golden has served as the spiritual leader of Congregation Avot Torah in Englewood, New Jersey since 1984. The membership of approximately 700 families, Avot Torah is the largest Orthodox synagogue in northern New Jersey. Rabbi Golden is the author of four popular and extremely well-received volumes on the Torah, called Unlocking the Torah Text. He has volumes on Bereshit, Shmot, Vayikra, and Bamidbar, put out by Geffen Publishing and OU. He has authored several articles on a variety of topics and received numerous awards, and he is, of course, the past president of the Rabbinical Council of America. Rabbi Asher Lopatin is the president of Yeshivat Chovei Torah Rabbinical School. Previously, he was the spiritual leader of Anshe Shalom B'nai Israel Congregation, which is a modern Orthodox synagogue in Chicago, and he was there for 18 years. He received his ordination from Aaron Soloveitchik at Yeshiva Brisk in Chicago and from YU. As a Wexner Graduate Fellow and a Rhodes Scholar with an MPhil in Medieval Arabic from Oxford, he is also the author of numerous scholarly and popular articles. Please welcome our speakers. The purported topic of this discussion, open orthodoxy, has received a lot of print and various kinds of media discussion. I, for one, am not want to begin with definitions of these terms because I'm never sure what it is that we're actually talking about when we're talking about these things. So we're going to begin very simply by asking, what is open orthodoxy? Rabbi Golden, you refer to open orthodoxy as a movement, and Rabbi Lopatin, you refer to it as an approach. You say, quote, it's a way of learning. It's a methodology within orthodoxy. Just like modern or centrist or ultra-orthodoxy, it's a part of the vision of the Masoret that we're trying to enact in the world. I, for one, want to know what that means exactly, because I don't know what that means. And I'd also like to know if one of the students asked if open orthodoxy implies that there is a closed orthodoxy and what that would be. So I'd like to, for both of you to explain your views and the difference between them. Let's begin with Rabbi Lopatin.
So much. It's really it's a great honor to be here, and I'm very excited that it's Tet B'Adar. And if you've been following, I don't know if you got things from Pardes or Beit Hillel. This is the day when, sadly, way back 2,000 years ago, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel began to really duke it out and fight, and ultimately it ended with killings. And so our Masoret tells us that this could be a very sad day. In fact, there were minhagim of fasting today, but I'm so excited that this, right here at University of Pennsylvania, this will be a tikkun. This will be a real healing for that, because I think this is going to be a very warm and civil and loving discussion. So I'm a great admirer of Rabbi Golden and a great admirer of Torah in Motion. So I'm very excited to be doing it. Dafka, I don't know if we planned it for this, but Dafka on Tet B'Adar. So we're going to kick off this day. So I wanted to... open orthodoxy, actually, this week's Parsha and in Tetzaveh, the Netziv, talks about a closed way of learning and an open way of learning. And the Netziv says, and you got to look it up in the Hamek Tavar, it's amazing. And he uses this kind of thinking all over the Torah, but he says that you need both. You actually need a kind of a closed, which he says is the Aron HaKodesh, represented by the Ark, you need a kind of learning that's a closed box. Rav Rosenzweig, Yeshiva University, talked about this in some articles about halacha. You need to just go over and learn the Masorah and learn the tradition and learn everything that has been passed down. But the Netziv, 100 years ago, over 100 years ago, said that's not enough. Closed Orthodoxy, closed Judaism is important, but you also need an open Orthodoxy, an open way of learning. And he says that's symbolized by the menorah, by the chokhmot chitzoniyot, by external sciences, and all sorts of ideas. He says any kind of ideas that gets us to be innovative, that gets us to take a new look at the Masoret. So actually, some people say, well, open Orthodoxy and, you're criticizing a closed Orthodoxy. No, we need an element of where we're closed. Sometimes that might be going to day school and not going to public school. Or it might be going to shul and not just on Shabbos and not just, walking around the neighborhood. There is that element of being in a box, but we also have to be able to get out of the box. And the Netziv says you're not going to have Torah growing. You're not going to have Hashem's Torah coming to this world without that as well. So that was always going on, this kind of being open to external elements. And Netziv, who was the Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin, yearned for that as well, though didn't implement it in the yeshiva in Volozhin. I think nowadays, when we have, we spent decades and decades as modern Orthodox, and we spent centuries dealing with the Enlightenment, we can really have an appreciation for opening up, being open to the world, sending rabbis everywhere in the world, not being, not having to be in one community or in one way of being a rabbi, maybe rabbis and non-for-profits. So that's part of this openness. But I also don't think it's a movement. You could say it's dynamic Orthodoxy, it's modern Orthodoxy, it's postmodern Orthodoxy, open or they're all parts of being a Jew and being a thinking Torah and, God willing, observant Jew.
Thank you. First of all, is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, I also would like to express my thanks to all of you for coming, and very much am honored to be here. Again, I admire Rabbi Lopatin, Dr. Melamed. It's a pleasure to be here. Rabbi Lopatin, we've spoken about this before. To suggest that there's a need for open Orthodoxy in a new way, in a different way, is suggesting that the rest of us, it seems to me, have been somewhat closed over the years. As someone who has learned at Yeshiva University under Rav Soloveitchik, there are very few people, I feel, who were more open to the outside world and to recognizing the dangers and the concerns, as well as the challenges and the benefits and the beauty that can come from the outside world. I grew up in the Yeshiva University world. We practiced open Orthodoxy, we questioned, we struggled, but there was a very, very strong recognition of the value of the halachic process, and a very strong recognition that the only reason we're sitting here today and recognizing each other as Jews is because we showed a loyalty to a process over the centuries that struggled with change and struggled with preservation in a very real, thoughtful, careful way. Those of us who are sitting on the outside of the Chovavei Torah open Orthodoxy do not see it simply as a way of thinking. Our perspective is that you've really started a movement. The movement consists of the school, it consists of a rabbinic organization, it consists of Yeshivat Maharad, it consists of a whole range of established organizations that, to our mind, are somewhat agenda-driven. Basically, what you're saying is we're going to push the envelope at every single possible place where we can find leniencies. We're going to rely on individual opinions as opposed to consultation and collaboration with the community at large. And we're going to push that envelope in a way which is going to say, this is what we think is right, this is what we think should happen, and it's up to the Orthodox community to accept our point of view. And if not, then you can continue doing what you want. When I say accept our point of view, meaning not that we all have to agree with you, but we have to agree that what you're doing is Orthodox. And that's kind of hard for us here, because what's happening is you're picking the critical issues that are very, very, very concerning to all of us. And instead of sitting down collaboratively trying to find how the Orthodox community at large can deal with these issues, you're making decisions and dealing with them in ways that I feel is going to split the Orthodox community in a very real way and can have very serious ramifications. So my fear, and this is the fear that I've expressed when we've spoken before, is that by following the path that you are mapping out for yourselves, you're not just postulating a way of thinking, but you're postulating a way of doing that is going to divide the Orthodox community irreparably.
A brief comment on that. I agree very much with recapturing the Torah of Rav Soloveitchik. I think that in some ways, what we're trying to do at Yeshivat Chovei Torah is almost reclaim modern Orthodoxy. I remember that when I was at YU, a lot of the Rosh Hashivas talked about Rav Soloveitchik, and they said, you know, when we went to his apartment, we never saw philosophy books. You know, he was a Talmid Chacham who just learned, and forget about the philosophy. So there's really been a lot of revisionism, and we really are trying to recapture the modern Orthodoxy of not only Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, but Rav Eliezer Berkovitz, Rav Rachman, David Hartman, who's a very interesting voice. And yes, let's question, is that Orthodox or not? But let's not close ourselves off from these voices. And I think, you know, in a sense, we're a yeshiva, and our rabbanim are Rav Linzer and Rav Love and Rav Katz, and they will disagree on a lot of these issues. We're not coming up with a sense of, you know, that this is what you have to do. We're really just training people and in an approach of being independent, creative. And I love the idea of this collaborative effort. Let's have a collaborative effort. Let's debate these issues. I love it. That's critical. And maybe are they agenda driven? I don't know. Who's to say what, you know, each person, when they look at the Shulchan Aruch, when they look at the Aruch HaShulchan, when they look at different works of Psak, are they bringing their own feelings and their own values and their own background into it? Certainly. And so everything is going to have some subjectivity, some agenda. But the critical thing is exactly what Rabbi Golden said. Let's be collaborative. Let's have these discussions and civil arguments. And that's the way the halachic process works, not by dismissing anyone and cutting anyone out, but saying, okay, show me your arguments. You want to do this? You think that this is okay? Show me, you know, show me the, where's the beef? Show me the money. Show me the halacha. And so I love that approach. And yeah, and everyone, Chovei Torah, Yeshiva University, the Gush, Ma'ale Gibor, Eretz Atzvi, wherever you are, you have to be ready for this pilpul, for this argumentation, and you better be ready to defend your arguments. And we're trying to train Talmidim to speak up, but also to be ready to defend and change their minds. And maybe something you say that you think is right, you'll see that, no, it's not the way you thought it was. So I totally agree with this sense of coming together and arguing. I just want to end with, like, you know, we have, thank God, 85 graduates throughout the country. I mean, to be a movement, I mean, requires a certain threshold. So I'm flattered that some people might think it's a whole movement. But we're an important yeshiva, and it's an important way of thinking. It's just adding, I think, to the texture of the Orthodox and Jewish world.
It's so hard sometimes to argue with you, Rabbi Lopatin, because so much of what you say, theoretically and philosophically, I agree with. Collaborative, working together, speaking together. The problem is that the facts on the ground don't lend themselves to that kind of collaboration. There are very critical issues, and here I'm talking to a university audience where I'm sure there are going to be very different perspectives on a lot of these different issues, and I'll be looking forward to your questions as well. But let's take the issue of Yeshivat Maharat, for example, and the decision to ordain women as rabbis within the Jewish community, within the Orthodox movement.
As clergy.
At as clergy only because the RCA got involved and insisted that it be not as rabbis.
Collaborative process.
Well, that's not the collaborative process. That's debate and argument after the fact. Basically, what my question to you is the following. If I wake up tomorrow and I decide that it's appropriate for the Orthodox movement to follow a particular direction, and I, on my own, Shmuel Golden, decide that I'm going to start a yeshiva, and that yeshiva is going to follow that direction, which clearly has not been the direction of the Orthodox community till now. And I'm going to call it Orthodox because I want to remain part of the Orthodox community. But I'm not going to collaborate. I'm not going to discuss. I'm not going to talk with the other rabbis to determine whether this is the right way to go. I'm going to make that decision and I'm going to do it. And then after the fact, I'm going to get upset when the Orthodox community says, you know what? That's not the direction, whatever that issue may be. That's not the direction that we think the Orthodox community should be moving in right now. Is that collaboration? I don't call that collaboration. I call that making your mind up. I call it being a lone ranger, determining the path that you think halacha should go, acting on it, creating facts on the ground, and then trying to get the Orthodox community to go there. That's not the way halacha works.
So a very good question. It's a good issue to discuss. First of all, there's a great article by Shlomo Brody and Rav Michael Broyd about that, whether giving smicha to women is a halachic issue or an issue of minhag. Then you got to go into Broyd versus Frindell, whether a minhag is really a halacha. But basically, I think this article, and Shlomo Brody, you know, he's at Yeshivat HaKotel, really argues that we're talking about changing or developing a minhag. I actually think that the basic idea, women in clergy, Beis Yaakovs for many years have been classifying their teachers as clergy in order to get tax benefits, parsonage. And I remember when Rachel Cole Feingold, who is now a Maharad in Montreal, but when she worked at my shul as educational ritual director, and she would give sermons and would do a lot of things that an assistant rabbi would do, we actually asked Rabbi Broyd, and he said, of course, she's clergy. You know, she comes, she does what clergy does. So that's not such a chiddush to call someone clergy. This idea of giving them a title, I heard it first at an RCA convention where they said, Rav Gideon Rothstein said, you know, we have to come up with a certain title. We don't want rabbi, that's controversial. I love the idea of rabbanit. And the Chidah mentions, you can read Mark Shapiro's article on the Sfarim blog, mentions rabbanit as a wise woman. But I don't know, no one bought my idea, except for Beit Hillel now calls women groups of discussions, they're called rabbanit. Whether or not their husband's a rav or not, they're called rabbanit, and there's no controversy. So the idea of a title, rabbah, you know, pushed a lot of buttons, but the general idea of a title, whether it's maharat, whether it's a chachama, whether it's what Nishmat is doing, or Matan is doing, or Rabbi Riskin is doing, you know, it's giving titles or not giving titles, it's basically... we're not dealing with something that's so revolutionary, and we're not dealing with something that's out of the mainstream. I think Nishmat and Maharat and Rabbi Riskin and Midrash Lindenbaum, these are mainstream institutions within modern Orthodoxy, within Orthodoxy. And so, yes, I think Rav Avi Weiss and Yeshivat Maharat maybe is pushing a little bit more, also using all this language of clergy and ordination and Maharat, but... I'll just end off with that Rav Daniel Sperber is signing their samchut documents of these women. And Rav Daniel Sperber is the head of the kollel at Bar Ilan University, which is an Orthodox university. It's an Orthodox kollel. So for me, that's very important to see that a central figure... Rav Daniel Sperber is a central figure in Orthodoxy. He speaks Rabbanei Tzohar. You can't dismiss him. And he is endorsing this. So, yes, it definitely is pushing the envelope and And I appreciate you have to be ready for the onslaught of criticism. And I actually think that was a healthy process. Rabah pushed too many buttons. It wasn't appropriate at the time. And so Rav Avi, now they're called Maharat. And we'll see what the final title will be. But it's not something that really is so much out of orthodoxy.
Okay. I want to really be clear here because it's important that what? On. It's important that you all understand where I'm coming from as well. I'm one of the first rabbis to participate and endorse within our area the Yoetz and Halacha program from Nishmat, which encourages women to learn, particularly in areas of Tarat HaMishpacha, and to serve within synagogues and to play an educational role within the synagogue in a very clear and beautiful way. And I've stood for that, and I believe that it's increased the observance and understanding of Tarat HaMishpacha in my community. So I am fully in favor of women playing roles, and important roles, and roles that, within the context of their scholarship, rises to leadership within the Jewish community. However, again, the way that Nishmat did this was collaboratively. They spoke to the rabbis in the field. They determined which rabbis would like to have these individuals move into the community. Rabbis like myself went out, took positions, fought for this, and it became more accepted within the Jewish community. As soon as, I was going to hope not to use particular names, but you brought Avi, who I love and respect for many years. But as soon as Avi decided, well, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to create a new reality that goes well beyond what the existing Orthodox community now accepts. I'm going to establish it and then fight to ensure that everyone else is going to accept it. That's not the way the process works. And because of that, it became harder. And this is really what I find most upsetting. It became harder for rabbis like myself to support programs like Yoetz and Halacha because it polarized the community. And those who were more to my right turned to me and said, you see, you were starting with Yoetz and Halacha, look where it goes, look what's happening, and instead of working collaboratively with the community, you factionalize the community, and it creates more problems than it solves. So it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is finding ways to work within the halachic system to meet each situation, to judge it on its merits, and not to say, well, this is where I think it has to go, this is where I think it should be, and I'm just going to do it and expect everybody else to play catch-up.
I would just say two of the three Maharats that are around, Ruthie Belinsky and also in St. Louis, they are at OU synagogues. So I don't want to put the OU on the spot. I guess it's being recorded. But, you know, because they understand that these are women that are just teaching Torah, that are talking about halacha, that are not training women to be, you know, radical, rebellious wives against their husbands or anything like that. They're just teaching Torah. And I think that to allow the rabbis in Teaneck, the right wing in Teaneck or wherever it is, to push us against our beliefs in, you know, Etzen Halacha or modern orthodoxy, I heard that almost no rabbis now endorsed Yoetz and Halacha in Teaneck, and it might be because, oy, it's a slippery slope, but we just can't allow the important values that we have of having women connecting to other women and teaching in our community. We can't allow that to scare us into not moving forward and not moving in a way that we should move. I mean, you look at the Muslim world, and they are so far behind, the UN reported, because they're not allowing women to achieve the positions they should have. They're cutting them off. And I think we have to be much more we can't afford to cut off women from these roles that the Maharat women have. Now, the GPATS program at Yeshiva University is also an excellent program, and they're beginning to have more counseling courses and really turn it not just into a program that trains women in Talmud or Halacha, but really to be these kind of role models and religious leaders in synagogues. And I just want to mention that in Riverdale, Dina Nyman, who was the Rosh Kehillah at KOE in Manhattan, now is starting at least once a month a wonderful Kehillah. We have over 150 people came. And these are not radical people. These are people that say a woman is there, she's teaching Torah, she's, you know, giving the sermon, she's helping shape a community. That's wonderful. And I would challenge these shuls that call themselves modern Orthodox. Why are you not having more women teach in the middle of service, in the middle before Kriyat HaTorah, introducing Kriyat HaTorah, or in not just at the very end of services, maybe? You know, I would challenge them, and I think that that is, you know, they are taking Torah away from people. They're not giving people the opportunity of learning Torah from people who can't teach Torah.
Wow, you're really something, you know? So from my point of view, you've spent 20 minutes basically dancing around the issue. So let's get to the issue, okay? On the one hand, you're saying that you're trying to say, Rabbi Lopatin, are trying to say that what you do at YCT or what it represents is actually part of a long tradition of openness that you trace back to the Netziv. Which seems to me dubious would be an understatement for that idea. Okay, so a person on the left of you, which is really where I'm thinking, would say to you, "I don't want to hear about the articles that you've read or the people that you're citing. Do you feel A, that YCT collaborates with other institutions?" In other words, Rabbi Golden is basically trying to ask you, if you believe in what you believe, why didn't you come and try and work it out with the rest of the community? Now, my thought would have been that your honest answer would have been because they wouldn't give us the time of day. If we went to them and we said we'd like to ordain female rabbis because we think it's the right thing to do in the 21st century and own up to that idea, and the thought would be, but they really wouldn't play ball with us at all, which is a thought I could actually understand. But instead, I feel like you're prevaricating between two positions. Do you believe in it? If somebody said to you, do you believe in the ordination of women? Would the answer be yes or no? If you cite Daniel Sperber, who is an enormous Talmid Chacham, but actually the citation of that example proves the point. Because as well known, you basically have Rabbi Sperber and very few others on one side and everybody else on the other side. Right? So I can be in complete sympathy with ordaining women. I can be in complete sympathy with Rabbi Sperber as a legitimate voice in the halachic process, but it actually only adds to Rabbi Golden's question. So either you say, no, this is the path we take, and these are the people we rely on, and we'd love it to be collaborative, but it's not going to be collaborative because the rest of the community won't buy in, or you sort of do what you're doing, which is to pretend that it's really all okay. In other words, why not just say what the position is and stand by it?
Well, I think that it is okay for women to be in that rabbinic role, and I think it's about time, and I think ordaining women, that whole term ordination doesn't even sound so Jewish to me, so...
No, I'm sorry. Of course it's Jewish.
Oh, really?
In other words, if we're saying smicha for men,
right,
the people are arguing about ordaining women, right, want the dignity of using the same language, and my feeling is, and I think a lot of people's feeling is, that the only reason that we're dancing around obvious language is because of the perception of the enormous resistance that's going to come once you use those words. But if you believe in the idea, then you use the words. If you don't believe in the idea, then we dance around and we use other language.
JTS decided there years ago they were not going to give smicha, they were going to give ordination. I think, you know, my yeshiva, Brisk, and Rav Yitzchak Elchanan gave smicha. So, yeah, smicha for women, I definitely support it. First of all, on the Netziv, if you read Menachem Fish's book, Rational Rabbis, if you read Gil Pearl's book on the Netziv. And from what I've heard, I haven't read it yet, but Professor Mirsky has a new book on Rav Kook where he talks a lot about the Netziv. I disagree with you very much. I think it's very consistent with the Netziv's thinking. And if you look at the political stance that the Netziv took on the Achdut, the unity of the Jewish community, I think you'll see it is consistent. But having said that, look, what can I say? Our rabbis are interviewing for Young Israel Synagogues. They brought in one of our rabbis in Boston. You can call the head of the committee, a wonderful man, who said that everyone on that committee, the Young Israel of Brookline, was interested in meeting Chovei rabbis. They had no problems with it. There are Chovei rabbis hired by the Orthodox Union to be on campus. There are, of course, dozens of Chovei rabbis that are at OU synagogues. So the truth is, yes, institutions, there are issues, there are difficulties with institutions sort of fighting each other, and the RCA not wanting Chovei rabbis or not accepting Chovei smicha. The truth is, I think Chovei, we need to reapply and really put the RCA, finalize this. But the appearance is that that these institutions are fighting. But when you go on the ground in college campuses, at synagogues, you see that it's not true. It's not like Chovei's on one side and open Orthodoxy or modern, is on one side, and it's not that IRF, the International Rabbinic Federation, is on one side and everyone else on the other side. The truth is, people are having these discussions, and they're healthy discussions, and I think we do need to sit down and talk about how to have healthy blogs and how people can speak in a civil way, because they're not always civil. But I would read Rav Avi Shafran's recent article about egalitarianism and about women leading services. And that's a beautiful example about a civil approach to it. He talks about how he doesn't like leading services, but he knows that some guys do. And so he can imagine that some women want to as well, and he's not judging them. It's a very beautiful article. And I think that I hope that the world is learning that we can have these arguments and discussions, and we can even say that this is not proper halachically. Rav Herschel Schachter thinks that women rabbis is an iser halachic. Women presidents, there are Rashi Yeshiva YU that think women presidents of synagogues is aser, mishum srara. So let's have these arguments, but I don't see it on the ground that there is this real big schism. I actually think that there are people that are in the Hasidic world that are much closer to us. There are people that are in the Haredi world that have a lot of problems with the modern Orthodox world. I'm seeing on the ground, and this is as a president of an institution where our rabbis are going out and meeting the people on the ground and meeting the selection committees, that there isn't so much of a schism, and there shouldn't be, because we're all committed to halacha, we're all committed to Torah, we are all committed to Torah mina shamayim, and why should there be? Why should there be a schism?
Rabbi Lopatin. I love you, and I love.
Thank you. I feel the love.
But get ready. let's understand a few things. The Netziv would not be in favor of ordination of women. To continue to quote various different and select various different articles and quotes and pieces to support. If you feel that there is not a schism, then I think you're dreaming. I think you have to sit at an executive council meeting of the Rabbinical Council of America, which boasts 1,000 rabbis and is supposed to be the mainstream organization, and to recognize the strong sentiment of upset that is being felt by the mainstream organizations, not by what you're saying, but by what you're doing. And that's the key. I had a woman president in my congregation. I know that Rav Schachter is against it. I had a woman president in my congregation because for a series of political reasons, she was the best choice. When I decided to do that, I went to Rav Gedalia Schwartz, the Rosh Bezdin of the RCA, And I said, Rav Schwartz, I have a particular situation in my community. This woman is the best equipped to take this leadership position. I want to make sure that what I'm doing is within consonance of the normative community's standards and halachic standards of the community, because I don't want my synagogue to be outside of that community. That's called collaboration. That's called sitting down and trying to work within a system to address. And he actually determined that in the situation that I was presenting, this was the best road for us to follow. I'm proud to say she served admirably for the year she served. There was only one uncomfortable moment that I can remember, and that is that I received an award from the OU along with a series of other rabbis. And in each case, the award at the dinner was presented by the synagogue president. And after the award was presented, the president hugged the rabbi. And I was the only one whose president did not hug the rabbi. But beyond that, she did an admirable job. I believe that women should be educated to the same extent as men should be educated. I believe that the Orthodox community should find leadership roles for women that will satisfy them in terms of their desire to serve within the public sphere, and that will challenge them and allow their scholarship and their knowledge and their talent to be able to participate and enhance the Jewish community. I just believe that it has to be done the right way. And our argument with you, Rabbi Lopatin, and with Chovavei Torah, and with this entire open Orthodox movement, is that it is not happening the right way. That decisions are being made concerning particularly difficult issues, and not just women ordination, concerning serious other areas, whether it be the structure of tefillah, whether it be issues concerning how we deal with the gay community, which is a critical issue for the Jewish community and the Orthodox community. But decisions are being made. And again, the expectation is we're doing it. We're doing it our way. And now Orthodoxy has to accept that. And I want to share one thing. And this will crystallize some of the concerns that we all have. As I said before, the only reason we're sitting here today recognizing each other as Jews after thousands of years is because our people respected the halachic process. The only thing that held us together as a common language was really Jewish law and Jewish and practice. We were spread all over the world, and we recognize it's a miracle. It's a miraculous thing. And part of that process was that you had to recognize that any critical decision you made could potentially have unintended consequences that would go well beyond that decision. And therefore, you had to think carefully before you acted, and you had to determine. And I'll tell you how when this particular lesson became very clear to me. I moved into Englewood, New Jersey, and I was followed afterwards by a conservative rabbi with whom I'd been somewhat close, who had been in Maryland before, and I had been in Maryland before, so we knew each other. As soon as he arrived, he called me up. He was the rabbi that took over from Rabbi Hertzberg and Temple Emanuel in Englewood, that the synagogue has since moved from Englewood. And he said to me, Shmuel, he said, I want you to know that I'm jealous. I said, his name was Rabbi Lisfield. I said, Stephen, why are you jealous? He said, I'm jealous because you have a community. You have a synagogue, and your community lives around your synagogue. And on Shabbos, people are walking and they're spending time with each other, and there's a Shabbos and you can feel Shabbos in the streets. He says, I have a synagogue in Englewood, and my people live in Closter and in Demarest and in Tenafly. They're all over the place. And it was at that moment that I realized something very important, that the decision that was made by the conservative movement to allow driving on Shabbos to shul, which at the time that it was made was a very logical decision, because what they were doing was they were saying, we're moving to the suburbs and everybody is spreading out and we've got to keep those far-flung people close, so we're going to allow them to drive to shul. That decision didn't work. First of all, it didn't work because once you allow driving for anything, people were going to drive otherwise as well. But beyond that, that decision had the unintended consequence of destroying the insular conservative community. Because once you allowed people to drive, what you did was you encouraged people to move far away from shul. Why should you pay three times as much to live near Avos Torah in Englewood, New Jersey, if you don't have to walk? And what finally happened was that the destruction of the insular conservative community took place because of what was at that point a particularly logical, wonderfully logical decision that they manipulated the halacha to reach. That's not the way things work. The way things work is you have a problem, you have an issue, you have a concern, you have a challenge. You don't decide beforehand where you want to end up. You look at it, you collaborate, you discuss, you take the texts, you determine the sources, and you try to determine where the halacha is going to take you. You may have a dream of getting somewhere, but you may not always get to that particular conclusion. And maybe that's good, because you never know what the intended consequences of that conclusion can be.
So, Rabbi Golan, I respect you not only as a person, a mensch, and a thinker, but also as a shul rabbi for so many years. And I think what you're doing, what you're bringing together is, or mixing maybe, is public policy and halacha. I actually think that the mistake of the conservative movement in the decision of driving on Shabbat was a halachic decision, because the conservative movement made the leap of saying that driving on Shabbat is just aser midrabanan, that it's because it's a rabbinic prohibition. That huge leap from saying that it's a Torah violation to a derabanan. Derabanans also are serious things, but that huge leap was not vetted halachically. And I actually think that it's dangerous to always say, slippery slope, we're worried about this. Tova Hartman says that some of these things are a slippery slope up to heaven, up to Shemayim. They're a uphill, wonderful slope. Let's slide some more. And I think that it becomes very difficult and very ossifying to say that, this is a slippery slope and unintended consequences. Let's be rigorous halachically. Let's have rigorous halachic arguments. Rabbi Ethan Tucker has a 100-page beautiful tshuva on egalitarianism that I think needs to be taken very seriously halachically. His recent argument on women in tefillin, and he's a very good friend, and I admire him and respect him, his recent argument on tefillin also has to be discussed, and it's a very different approach that he has. It's a less traditional halachic approach. But we have to argue these things. We have to believe that halacha and the halachic process is strong and vibrant, and that if we have honest disagreements, rather than saying, but there is a slippery slope. What's going to happen? Unintended consequences. Let's trust the Torah process. I want to mention that sometimes, what Hovei Torah students do, Talmidim do, is they go out all over and they try to bring halacha and Torah to places that sometimes are resistant to it. So one of our Rabbanim in Boston brought in Rabbi Love, our posek at the yeshiva, and to give a hechsher to come and check out, to give hashkacha, to Maim Chaim, which is a mikvah in Boston. It's used mostly by the renewal community, the non-Orthodox community. It's a beautiful thing. Anita Diamond started it. But is it a kosher mikvah? So he brought in Rabbi Love. And I got a phone call from a local rabbi in Boston saying, how could you bring in this? We didn't want to give it, it would be okay, but we felt that you shouldn't give hashkacha to this mikvah. People should be using the other mikvah. Politics and public policy. And meanwhile, they didn't want Rabbi Love and our rabbeim to be machshir that mikvah because, we have our own mikvah. I think we have to move beyond this, and I don't think we can afford to have these kind of restrictions. So thank God there is Maim Chaim is under Hashkacha, and in Finland, our musmach in Finland, Rav Simon Lipson, is building the first mikvah in Helsinki. The Chabad used to go to, to Amsterdam, Denmark, wherever they went to. Now they can use the mikvah in Finland. And so I think this is really, when you're not afraid, and when you actually say, let's look at the halacha and let's have an honest argument about the halacha, that's fine. I want to just one more thing, and that is that the Netziv's wife, Raina Batya is one of the early sources for not, she hated the bracha shelo asani isha. So I don't know what the Nitziv would have said about women rabbis, but he was married to a woman who pre-feminism had issues with some of our liturgy that is very contemporary. So, and maybe he argued with her a lot, but I think that looking at these earlier sources is critical. And yes, we can't be anachronistic. We can't, you know, they're living a century and a half ago. But nope, I have not been convinced today that to dismiss the Nitziv and say he would never agree to any of this. He provides, I think, the foundation, as many, many others do, for being open to innovation, to creative thinking, to looking at the halacha and studying it honestly without fear.
I'm only going to take 2 seconds. To assume, to say that Chovavei Torah Musmachim are going out into the hinterlands and fighting the good battle, I give you tremendous credit for that. But to assume that they are the only ones doing that, or that that hasn't been done by Yeshiva University rabbis who have gone out for decades into these places and worked very hard and tried to bring Yahadus is... You know, it's almost as if I see this periodically from some of your musmachim, we're the ones who are doing these things. We're the ones when in reality we've been doing them for decades. And again, I will say, however, that were someone from Yeshiva University to go in and determine whether or not the mikvah at Mayim Chaim should be acceptable or not, I tend to think that rabbi would have gone to the community, discussed with the existing rabbinate in the community what the issues were and why they felt they had not given that mikvah hashgacha for whatever reason, be it halachic or public policy, and would have then made the decision whether to do so, rather than, once again, going, doing something that, for whatever reason, you feel needs to be done, without at least taking into concern the sensitivities and the concerns of the existing community to determine how it should be done. It's a perfect example of the kind of thing that I'm talking about, where what you're doing is you're saying, we'll do it our way, and then you guys got to come along.
And I would agree with you.
No. Let's move the discussion along.
Do shake
you guys
up a little bit.
The turf war.
Shake up the establishment. So
Judaism is not just a turf war between YCT and YU, right? It's unbelievable.
No,
you know,
turf
there's
I'm a YU Muslim.
The YU Muslim. The Pew report. I mean, to me, sometimes I listen to Orthodox rabbis fiddle while Jewry burns. You know, the Pew report is showing how lost many Jews have become to Jewish tradition and practice. And I feel sometimes like, have we lost sight of the really important issues in our world? Put another way, like, what is Orthodoxy today? Is Orthodoxy real? Is it significant? Is it just a modern label meant to react to Reform polemic of the 19th century? When you answered an earlier question, I was struck by how many adjectives you kept throwing in front of the word Orthodoxy, to the point where it's adjectively driven into the ground and in fact kind of lost its usefulness. Isn't part of the problem here the very definition of Orthodoxy, the very meaning of it in the world has become blurred and confused? Isn't it really about Judaism as opposed to Orthodoxy?
Maybe I'll speak first this time. I agree with you 100%. And it drives me crazy, and it pains me terribly to see us having to spend time on some of these issues when I believe that someday HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to turn to the American Orthodox community and say, where the heck were you when all this was happening? You know, and how could you have officiated over the demise of American Jewry without paying attention? And that's why, on a personal level, I'll just speak personally, that over the last couple of years, I've made real efforts to try to speak to the conservative and reform communities, the rabbis in our community. We've had panel discussions in my shul, trying to bring people from various different communities together to try to, and I'm going to be speaking on a panel this coming Wednesday evening at the JCC on the Palisades, dealing with the issue of the Pew Report and trying to determine what can be done and how we can move forward. I have my own particular feelings about the Pew Report, and I'll just say one thing. and it does tie into our discussion here. One of the reactions to the Pew Report has been, well, Jews are drifting away from tradition. They're affiliating socially, culturally, not religiously. So what we have to do is we have to try to meet them where they are. In other words, so we've got to enhance our cultural, you know, stop talking about religion so much. And I couldn't disagree more. The reason that we're in a situation where Jews are affiliating only culturally and, you know, and all those is because we have failed to highlight the importance of what has held us together over the centuries. We've got to find out a way to make halachic Judaism relevant to as many Jews as we possibly can. And we have to do it without the label of kiruv. It has to be through education. And yes, I mean, you hit on a nerve here. I think that as an Orthodox rabbi, we have not done anywhere near enough. But that doesn't mean that it should be done by changing the halachic process or by watering it down. I think by doing that, we increase the problem rather than benefit. I've decided one day that when I finish what I'm writing now, I'd like to write a volume called Orthodoxy for the Non-Orthodox, where I would try to explain to those who are not part of the Orthodox community what are the things that we hold dear, and we're not who you think we are, and what are the things that might be worthwhile. Whether I'll ever do it or not, I don't know.
It's a little curious, though, right? Rabbi Lopatin, in a sense, got slaughtered in the press when he did something very commendable, right, which is to have a kind of interdenominational discussion as part of his inauguration, and it seems funny, given what you're saying, why he received such bad press then.
My reaction to that is that to have a panel discussion at his inauguration with non-Orthodox, I have no problem with that. I have no problem with that. I think it's important. I think that we as the Orthodox continue to treat the non-Orthodox movements as if they are a threat to our existence. That was true in the 1950s. It's not true today. The only threat to us is really the same threat to all of our children, which is secularization and assimilation. So I think we have to, so I have no problem with that.
Thank you. It's very edifying, and I appreciate the support. And I think, you know, this is what Chovei Musmachim are doing. I mean, I have this list of where our Musmachim are, and, you know, Yeshiva University.
By the way, I'm not a Chovei Musmach. I just want to make it.
We'll work on that. We'll work on that, Rabbi Golden. You know, decades ago, YU used to have all these programs, Torah leadership seminar, to Australia, to all over the place. And that's something I think that is inspired Chovei Torah, and we're sending people out, and we're sending people to do Jewish camping, Jewish farming, to work in non-for-profits and some social justice organizations, in shuls all over the South and all over the West and all over in Maine and in Seattle. And exactly, I think Rav Avi Weiss says very beautifully that we are training Orthodox rabbis to go out and to be Orthodox rabbis, but for all Jews on college campuses. The OU JLIC program hires more Chovei Torah rabbis for their program than any other yeshiva, any other.
This is not. So, this is not an advertisement for YCT or for YU.
This is my time,
right?
So no.
This is not an advertisement. This is not.
But we're gonna
wrap it up in a minute, and we're gonna throw it open to students.
Right. I think on this point we both agree. But I would say one thing. I have to say one thing, that the issues that we're talking about of inclusion, whether it's women, whether it's gender, whether it's non-religious in the synagogue, whatever those issues are, these are important issues, and these are a way of us making the Orthodox community, the Torah community, and the Torah way of life meaningful for people. Whether a convert can be the president of his or her shul is a big issue. That's not a nothing issue. And if you're saying, when you say that a woman can't be a president, you'll say a convert can't be president. I don't think that should be modern orthodoxy. I think that should be outside. That's orthodox, but it's outside the bounds of modern orthodoxy to me. So these are important issues, but of course, the context for it has to be that Torah goes out to the world, Torah reaches out to all Jews, and Torah can reach out and speak to everyone in this world. So I think you have agreement on that issue.
Do we have any questions from the floor? Do you want to ask? Okay, so I'm going to bring the mic around.
There's a mic over there.
The mic over there? Okay, right up there. Thank you. Thank you.
Earlier, Dr. Malamut raised the point. Is this thing on? Working? Earlier, Dr. Malamut raised the point that Rav Goldner was raising the question of how to approach an issue in the halakhic system and how why there hasn't been a preemptive form of discussion that before decisions were made. And I mean, personally, I feel like Rabbi Lopatin hasn't necessarily directly addressed that point as to why YCT has not come to YU or the RCA or other leaders of halakha and said, this is what we think is the right halakha, then let's sit down and discuss it. I was wondering, hopefully, maybe Rabbi Lopatin could explain why it is that that point hasn't been addressed, why it is that YCT hasn't used that methodology.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm a little, I'm not sure because YCT hasn't come out with a policy statement about all these kind of controversial issues. And I think Rabbanim at YCT will have different views of different things out there. And so, I don't know if we've sat down and come up with a policy, but I think that, as Dr. Malamud said, that maybe these forums are not there and they should be established. And, you know, it was, we felt, and there was a discussion to have that the RCA was not warm to accepting our musmachim. And frankly, I've hit the pavement and gone to lots of the Aguda breakfast and had lots of meetings with people and gone. I'm in Washington Heights at Yeshiva University a lot of times speaking to different people, and I've connected on a personal level, but there really isn't that forum to really discuss these issues. So, but I'll tell you, on the Aguna issue, Jofa has been a healthy forum there, and also recently Rav Linzer and Rav Bigman got together to discuss it in Washington, D.C. So there are these discussions that are going on important issues, but I totally agree with you. In fact, one of our musmachim just told me in California that one of the things I should push for is let's have these discussion forums together and let's allow everyone to come in and have these discussions. At Jofa, there was a great panel with Rav Linzer and Tamar Ross and Ethan Tucker and others. It was a very good discussion. So you're right, those are lacking, and we welcome that. And our Talmidim would benefit from it. I would love the YU Talmidim. So I tried. I wanted to have YU Talmidim, Chovei Talmidim go to Ner Yisrael for a few days. Ner Yisrael was not interested in it. No one was interested in it, but I hope that we really push for this idea of, you know, cross-fertilization.
I think the student's question was actually asking also on an official level. You've cited Rabbi Linzer, Dr. Ross, and Rabbi Tucker, all very smart, creative people, but it's clearly not the question the student was asking. The student is asking on an official level whether, say, YCT approached YU, RCA, et cetera, with some of their proposals about halachic evolution and change and tried to sit down and have a discussion. I'm hearing from you, correct me if I'm wrong, that either it wasn't made or you didn't feel it was possible for that approach to be made or it wasn't received properly, or give us a sense of whether such an approach was even made in the first place.
I'm not exactly sure of how you're defining on an official level, but can you explain that?
Because, sure. Richard
Joel and me sitting down, or
people are more involved, I guess, in the business of forging out Piskei Halakha or halachic decision making, and whether there's any contact on those levels.
Well, on the Aguna level, Ravbigman has been working on and has been trying. It's very difficult to bring people together. There's a lot of fear that people have that if they come together and sit down with Rav Linzer, that they'll get in trouble. So there definitely is that fear.
Maybe I'll challenge a little bit differently. The kinds of discussions that you're referring to are happening. They're happening in the RCA itself. I mean, the RCA is over 1,000 rabbis, and the rabbis are arguing with each other about everything from women's ordination to, and these are discussions. Rabbi Avi Weiss is a member of the RCA. Before he decided to establish Yeshivat Maharat, before he decided to move in that direction, to my knowledge, there was no consultation and no discussion. It wasn't, and this is, I think, I don't want to speak for you, the kind of question that I would ask. Should Rabbi Weiss have gone out and done that, or should he have turned to his fellow colleagues in the RCA and said, listen, I believe this is what's supposed to happen. I believe this is where we should be going. Let's open up the discussion, but I'm not going to act as a Lone Ranger. I'm not going to go out there and establish facts on the ground without, and if I consult with you and the overwhelming preponderance of rabbinic thought is in one direction, I'm not going to establish facts on the ground that I disagree with and expect you to accept that as orthodox. Now, he can do what he wants. He can establish Yeshivat Maharat, but then he can't then turn around and say that now is part of the orthodox mainstream if he hasn't gone through those processes.
So let me, if I'm getting the question a little bit better, there are several. There are listservs which have a lot of mixture. There are IRF rabbis, International Rabbinic Fellowship rabbis, 150, who are members of the RCA, who are their musmachim chove, their YU musmachim. So these conversations actually are happening on separate listservs, but also together. Just recently, the tefillin question of women in tefillin, I put something up on the RCA listserv. You know, the listservs sometimes got a little heated and get a little heated, and so there's a question of how helpful they are. But, you know, if you're talking about that kind of mixing of different rabbis, then, you know, I agree. It's going on, and it's not a hermetically sealed world. Rav Bigman,
I'm gonna push the envelope again. I'm sorry. Tell me if you think I'm being wrong. Discussion is one thing. Acting alone is another. That's the critical component here. The critical component is, yes, all of these discussions are taking place. They're important. They're critical. They cross-pollinate. This is important. But then when the time comes to make a resolution, to make a decision, to determine the direction of halacha, you sit down, you make a resolution, and you move on. You don't have one person stand up and say, I'm deciding where the halacha is going to go, and it really doesn't matter what everybody else thinks.
You're saying two different things. I agree with you about this consultation and discussion, and that needs to happen, and it should happen in every case. Whether the action a person determines, like that I have a minority of rabbanim who are with me, but I have to act, that's a different question. But I definitely agree with this consultation. And when you act alone, you do suffer the consequences. And, you know, we talked a lot. I think that there is an acceptance really in the Orthodox community, a broader acceptance, and sometimes appears from the organizational level.
Please. So maybe tailgating on this discussion, how would you, you cited in a specific case something in Boston that you would suggest that the in consultation with the local religious community, you know, come to a decision. And so I'm wondering, how do you fragment enough so that individual communities can have a certain space to have different halachas, and at what point does that become an issue of orthodoxy in general? At what point can there be simply just different communities with different practices that work for those communities?
That's an excellent question. What? Want to take a few questions at once? Okay. So, go ahead.
So we're going to have all students right, so first, gonna, please.
Yeah. All right, I'm just going to mark this down here.
Are you going to the mic?
Yes. So far, the impression I've gotten is that a lot of the controversy is arriving from the use of the term orthodox. So I guess I'm wondering if YCT didn't hold the Orthodox label, or you didn't affiliate with the Orthodox movement, would this controversy still be happening? And is there any other way of approaching the lifestyle of following halacha within the Jewish community and living a Torah observant life without using the label Orthodox or any derivatives?
First, as most of the students know, I'm Rabbi Howard Alpert. I'm a musmach of YU, proudly ordained by Yeshiva University, and also executive director of Hillel Greater Philadelphia, which operates Penn Hillel and other Hillels around the city. First, an observation. Thank you so much for coming. This was really a wonderful panel, and yashar koach to those of you who organized the day. This is terrific, and I'm proud that it's happening at Hillel. My observation is that the whole construct of Orthodox is really a late 19th century and early 20th century phenomena. That, in fact, it might be entirely irrelevant to the generation of halachically observant Jews growing up in the 21st century. That perhaps rather than using a political construct, Orthodox or Orthodox community as distinct from other religious Jewish communities, we begin to think of halachic Judaism or classical Judaism as opposed to liberal Judaism. That is, a Judaism which posits that at the center of Jewish life and Jewish thought is are actions and thoughts and understandings consistent with classical halacha, as opposed to putting human imagination at the center of Jewish life and using that to define Judaism. With that understanding, I have a question for each of our speakers. Rabbi Lipotin, to you, I ask, if in fact what we're talking about is not a political entity, orthodoxy, but rather a halachic understanding of Judaism, classical Judaism or halachic Judaism, what can we do to assure that the initiatives that YCT rabbis are taking and others are taking now, or might imagine taking in the future, remain within the halachic fold and don't, because of our own great imagination and ability to rationalize almost anything, move us outside of the halachic realm? To you, Rabbi Golden, my old friend and colleague, what can we do? Thank you. My longstanding. We're both rather old, but what can we do to assure that the political battles, which get fought within any community, in fact, are identified as such, and when necessary, laid aside so that the real issues, the ideological issues, and the issues that deal with halachic understanding, can be allowed to come to the fore. And in doing that, how can we move forward our understanding of what is possible within halacha as we try to meet the challenges of the 21st century?
Thank you.
Next. First, thank you all for being here this weekend. Rabbanit Henkin was actually just here over the course of Shabbat, and she spoke a lot about the Yotzot Halacha program that she founded at Nishmat. And I'd be curious to hear from a halachic standpoint, from both of your perspectives, what are the fundamental distinctions between the Yotzot Halacha program and Maharat? Where do you draw that line between what a Yotzot Halacha can do and what a Maharat can do? And also from both of your perspectives, why is the concept of Maharat either valid halachically or invalid halachically?
Building off that comment, I'd like to echo our thanks for you coming today. And I was actually very excited about this panel for the last couple of days since I heard about it. Though in the discussion so far, I've been a little bit disappointed that...
You and me both.
Thank you. That the discussion has revolved around two axes, which I think it would be better not to. The first is that it's focused a lot on the past instead of on the future.
Yeah.
The second, it's focused a lot on tactics instead of substance and differences. So Rabbi Golden mentioned earlier some of the substantive issues, that the challenging issues that face us today. And for our generation, will face this in the future. I was wondering if we could shift the discussion towards the future of those substantive issues.
I guess my question kind of takes a slightly something that I think we haven't really addressed yet. There's been a lot of discussion about consensus among the leadership and looking for consensus from RCA or from other rabbinic authorities. To what level do you think the leadership has a responsibility to respond to trends from the mass populace of, you know, people that want, the congregations that want more, and to what extent do they have a responsibility to hold true to the values that they see as important? You cited as an example Young Israel of Brookline, which, you know, while the community might be willing to look at YC rabbis, the existing rabbi wouldn't necessarily choose that as his successor. So to what level do those two different forces influence each other?
Okay, that's quite a quite a whack of questions. I think if I'm keeping score here, different kinds of Orthodox communities was really the first one, and either of you can.
Okay. I'm going to try to do a couple of things.
Sure.
All right. First of all, I think there were some very critical substantive questions that were asked, so let me try to deal with some of those first. Fragmenting or specific halachot or specific practices within different Jewish communities. Every community has its own dynamic, and the rabbis who are on the spot, who are on the ground in that community, have to be able to deal with that dynamic and bring that dynamic back to Poskim so that proper decisions can be made. As an example, I gave you the decision to have a woman president in my congregation, which might not have flown in other congregations, but was appropriate for mine. Similarly, someone asked me today whether I felt that Rabbi Hartstark's decision to allow in SAR, you guys are aware of this, the young women to put on tefillin. And I said that was a specific, unfortunately, that became a global issue. That was a specific decision made by Rabbi Hartstark, who knew those young women, who knew those girls, who knew where they were coming from, who felt their need and was responding for his particular community and for his particular congregation. And that is appropriate and that is right within the context of what he feels is allowable halachically. In terms of the moving to the young man who said that you're disappointed, I'm sorry, and I'd like to just talk to you about some of those substantive issues. And this also will answer the question of the young woman who spoke about being responsive to the community. Halacha is a very complex process, by which in every generation we have taken a law that has been eternal, but is given over to man. That's the unique nature of halacha. And that HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically says, if you're loyal to the process, I will agree with whatever decision you come to. But the key is you have to be loyal to the process. And what that means is it's not, and this answers someone else's questions, it's not just a consensus on a political level that we're looking for. It's following the process. It's trying to determine, how do we treat halacha appropriately? How do we respect this process? And look at every issue that's coming to us from the community. So, for example, women's role. Do I think there should be changes in women's role religiously? Yes, I do. I think it's based upon greater education for women. It's based on better opportunities for women. It's based on the fact that our social scene has changed. And now it's up to the rabbis to sit down, to challenge the halachic authorities, because we're the ones on the ground, and basically to say, okay, what are we going to do? A yoatzet halacha for me was a natural development. It was not something where I was trying to be revolutionary. I was saying, you know what? People in my community are not observing Taharat HaMishpacha. There are women who can speak to them, train them, who can play a role, who can even speak to the men in my community about Tarat HaMishpacha, because they will train, we will bring them in, and that will enhance the community. It's an opportunity to use women scholarship, learning, and at the same time to move the community along. It's that kind of natural progression, that kind of natural development. Should we look for other opportunities? 100%. But it's got to be done in a way that brings the community along and doesn't fragment the community beyond repair, which I think is what's going to happen if we're not careful. In the areas of the gay community and inclusion of the gay community, this is something that I believe the Orthodox community has to struggle with tremendously. I sat on the phone the other night, a few nights ago, with a parent group from Eshel, because someone in my community belongs to the group, and I said, it's very important for me as a rabbi to hear from the Orthodox parents of Orthodox kids who are gay what they're struggling with. And I spent an hour and a half on the phone with them listening to what they had to say so that I could bring back to my colleagues some of their concerns. And we have to find a way. We have to find a way to make people feel comfortable within the Orthodox community, but not by changing the basic rule. And that's our struggle. It's easy to say, okay, let's reread the Torah. Let's change it. We've got to follow in each one of these cases. We've got to hear what the community's asking. We've got to be concerned for where the community is. Otherwise, we're playing games. But at the same time, we have to be able to respond by showing a clear respect for the halachic process and answering it. So what did we do within the RCA, for example? We came out against reparative therapy, because we felt that after the psychologists, we felt that based upon what we were hearing from the psychologists, that we as an Orthodox community should not have people go to therapy that could be harmful or wrong. We've got to respond to these issues. But at the same time, are you going to ask me if I can change the Torah law that the male homosexual relationship is usher according to the Torah? And the female is usher according to the Rabbanan, if not to the Torah? There's nothing I can do to change that. What I can do is work with individuals to make them understand that everybody has challenges and we have to figure out how to deal with those challenges and keep you as part of the Orthodox community. So all of these, you are going to be facing in the days to come and in the years to come, challenge after challenge after challenge that will come from the community, that will come from a changing world. And you're going to have a choice. You're either going to say, and this is the best way to sum up when you ask me about the future, you're either going to say, you know what, the world's changing so fast, halakha has to be shifted around to meet everything we think is correct. Or you're going to say, let's forget halakha. Or you're going to say, let's close out the world. Or you're going to say what we've said for centuries, there's value to this, there's value to this, let's figure out a way to make it work. And the way you determine that will determine whether there are Jews here tomorrow affiliating as halachically observant Jews. So that's our challenge. I think I pretty much covered almost everything, at least the best I could.
I mean, Rev Golden, I think you spoke beautifully and eloquently about what modern Orthodoxy is and modern open Orthodoxy, whatever you call it. I think I agree with a lot of what you said. I think that looking at the future and Dr. Malamud, I'm the president of Yeshivat Cholvei Torah. Our job is to train rabbis. And when I'm looking at where they're going, to college campuses, to creating new types of chaplaincy in Israel where rabbis work with Muslims and Christians to train them to do chaplaincy for people of all different religions, I really feel that is the future, and where an Orthodox Jew can step in and have an impact in those areas. So I think that the reason I think Orthodox, the title Orthodox, is important is because I want to reclaim this heritage of Rav Berkowitz, of Rav Soloveitchik, of all the people. You know, nowadays, in Tradition magazine, people have said you'll never be able to have an article by Rabbi Berkowitz, Eliezer Berkowitz. You probably couldn't even have an article by Rav Soloveitchik. It wouldn't be allowed in there because there is an element of close Judaism, and that's why Rav Avi Weiss said we have to start a new seminary, a new yeshiva that will train rabbis to be open, to be creative, to be unafraid, and not afraid of being judged. When there was a discussion in another yeshiva about homosexuality, it was there was a violent reaction in the Beit Midrash, and it was condemned, and people apologized for it. I think we have to make sure that Eshel can come into the synagogues. We have to create the communities of the future that will welcome an Eshel. And also, when I was in Chicago, I took a stand on civil unions, that secular law should allow for same-sex couples to have a civil union. And I was criticized for it. And yet, that's not a halachic issue. That's just an issue of being open to society and saying, does the Torah really usher me from doing this? I know there has been a status quo. I know maybe there's even been a silence on certain issues. But let's use what we see in our environment to let us look and see, is this thing really usher, or is this something we should be passionate and positive about? And that's where I think the very good question about, you know, are we going to drift off into some kind of lukewarm, non-halachic world? We have to be passionate about halacha. I've gone around the country all the time talking about the importance of Torah Misinai, that God gave us this divine, infinite Torah that, exactly as Rabbi Golden said, we're struggling to try to understand it, and every generation is looking at it again with the input of everything, all the movements that are around, to understand this divine Torah. And so therefore, I think we have to be passionate about observance, about minyan, about kashrut, about tarat mishpacha, but to do it with meaning and to do it with an openness that we have to be look and study things and make sure we're getting closer to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. I want to just say one more point, and that is, I'm a libertarian. I believe in the free market of ideas, and I believe in free markets in general. And I don't like the idea of only having one hashkacha for the whole city. And yes, sometimes you do have to shake it up. And sometimes we know lots of cases where there is a hashkacha that is not allowing for enough restaurants, and maybe they have a very high standard, and maybe their priorities are not the priorities of the people. And yes, it is part of the future to have a certain openness in the system and to allow, maybe there's a secondary hashkacha. Now in Israel, they're looking at three different levels of hashkacha. You could either be scared of that and say, you know, our community is going to deteriorate and crumble if we have these other voices. Or you can say we're going to be stronger about it. We believe in Torah. We believe in halacha. We believe in the halachic methodology. And we're not afraid of a little bit of competition. And so I do think that there is a different vision. And again, it is a question of what is going to be meaningful for the next generation. You look in the Haredi world, young Haredi people want to be on the internet, and they want to work in Israel, and they want to go into the army in Israel. And so there is that kind of an openness that is challenging the leadership of their communities. And I think you see it in all levels of Orthodoxy and all levels of Judaism. You see in Reform and Conserve and Renewal a passion for halacha now, a passion for kashrut. So I hope that we can really galvanize that and not be afraid of the challenge that it gives, as long as we are passionate and committed to our Torah and our Mesoret that we love and that we cherish.
One last.
So a different question for each of you based on your comments. So first, Rabbi Lepatin, you mentioned earlier the difference or the distinction between halakha and public policy. Now, as we all know, there's in the classical text of halakha, there's a broad range of opinions. So my question for you, is there any case where something that could be done should be done? Meaning, in other words, is there a bridge too far? And if so, what is it for you? For Rav Golden, one of the challenges that I see in the future, and one of the reasons why, similar to the libertarian idea, is that there is now a vast literacy of of younger university students, sort of the success of, one of the successes of the day school movement, for instance, is that there are a lot more literate Jews. So you mentioned earlier the halachic process and that we should trust the halachic process and emunah chachamim. But you treated it as if it was a black box, that there are issues that come in, it's discussed almost, it seems almost behind closed doors, and then there's an answer to that. So the question is, what is inside the black box, and how is change efficated in it, actually?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, what is, sometimes there's a sense of pasnisht that is permissible, but does it have the right feel? So when I was a shul rabbi on Shabbat, there was a question. I did not let people, you know, carry their, we lived right near Wrigley Field. So, you know, carry their tickets, buy them before, and we had an Eruv, and go, you know, to Wrigley Field on Shabbat, because it hurt the atmosphere of Shabbat. On the other hand, and this I didn't get any, it wasn't controversial. We had a candy ice cream store that was owned by non-Jews, and we arranged to have people prepay and have accounts. So you could go to that ice cream store on Shabbat afternoon, and they would scoop your ice cream, and they would bill you, or sometimes the shul had a whole happy hour where everyone would get a free scoop of ice cream. And I was like petrified, like, I'm going to get it. Everyone's going to yell at me for this. And you know what? It was very much in keeping with the Shabbos atmosphere. And sometimes I think that you have to, sometimes you take a stand, almost an experimental stand, and then you see if it really is consistent. And I think that we're seeing actually in, there was a shul in the Frum neighborhood of West Rogers Park in Chicago that did a bat mitzvah for a girl who had two mothers, lesbian couple, had their daughter had a bat mitzvah. And they saw that they could do it, and it didn't end Judaism as we know it, and it didn't, you know, legitimize things that you want to legitimize. So you have to do, I agree with you, you have to listen, and you have to see the atmosphere, and you have to see whether this thing is working. And so once you come up with a decision, a psak, and an action plan, that doesn't mean that's the end. Go for it and don't listen to anyone. Keep checking yourself, and maybe you'll find in a few years that it didn't have the proper outcome. And that's also part of the process as well. So I do agree that there are red lines, but sometimes you really have to, you of course, you have to approach it with a halachic methodology and look at the post scheme and everything, but sometimes only after you do it, you'll realize whether it works properly or not.
Okay, the only thing I would say, Rabbi Lopatin, is given the current weather climate, why anybody in Chicago would want to eat ice cream is beyond me.
There is a summer in
maybe
Chicago.
Maybe hot chocolate would be more like it. In response to your question, which is truly an excellent one, there is no question that the process of psak halacha has changed in our day and is going through transformation, which we're not quite sure where it's going to end. Simply put, in Europe, if you were the shtut rav, if you were the rabbi of a community, and someone came to you and said, can I eat this chicken, and you gave an answer, that was the answer. Today, if you go to Shmuel Golden in Englewood, New Jersey, and you ask, can you eat the chicken, you then go on to the internet, you find 10 other rabbis who tell you whether or not you can eat the chicken, you go back to Rabbi Golden, and you say, how come so-and-so said I could eat the chicken when you said I couldn't? So it's I'm putting it very, very bluntly, but it is a challenge to rabbis because there's a marketplace of ideas out there, there's accessibility, and by the way, it's wonderful. However, it's challenging. In addition, we are dealing with a much more knowledgeable client base. We're dealing with people who go to yeshivot, who read books, who are much more knowledgeable and will challenge us. At the same time, and here I'm going to quote my teacher, Rav Soloveitchik, when he speaks about Parshas Korach. When he speaks about Parshas Korach, he talks about what was it. If you think about it, Korach was of all the events that occur in the Torah, of all the rebellions, the one that God seems to put down with the greatest strength is the rebellion of Korach. And the answer is because it was a rebellion against rabbinic authority, according to the Rav. It was a rebellion against the process. It wasn't rebellion against God. It basically said, Korach said, Kolo Eidah Kulam Kedoshim, which was correct. We are all holy. Therefore, we're all the same. and we can all make these decisions. So the Rav writes, and again, I'm not doing him justice. I'm not quoting him. I don't have the text before me. But he says, in any other area of expertise, you rely on the opinions of the experts to determine the way to go, right? You're not going to, you can read up about medicine and about medicines that you should take, but you're still going to go to the doctor. The doctor's going to prescribe. You may question him, but eventually rely on the opinions of experts. He says, in halacha, the same thing has to occur, or halacha will disintegrate. While everyone can have an opinion, and while everyone can discuss and determine and debate, at some point, the decisions that are made are going to have to rely upon those people who have dedicated their lives to the discussion, to the deliberation, the discussion, the understanding of the halachic process. Now, we have a problem. I'll be perfectly honest. In the modern Orthodox community, since the passing of the Rav, there is a vacuum. And there isn't anyone with that great stature who has been able to bring the community together around one person and say, well, if the Rav says it, you know, that's the way it is. But nonetheless, there still is this concept of rabbinic authority. Rabbinic authority within each town, within each city, within each place. And while we become more knowledgeable, we have to recognize that it's those people who have dedicated their lives to trying to understand the world and halacha at the same time who are going to have to eventually determine its course. Otherwise, we're going to end up with many different Judaisms, to use the words of the Ramban, as opposed to one direction which will keep us together. So it becomes critically important for the community and for the rabbinate to find a way in a world of greater knowledge to still nonetheless find a respect for rabbinic authority.
I mean, I don't seed your ideas. Don't say, you know, I have this idea, but I'm just going to seed it to rabbinic authority. I think Beit Hillel in Israel, which is a very mainstream Orthodox organization, has Batei Midrash, where people really openly discuss ideas. They have a wiki model where they have a psak and people comment on it. I think that it's very important. Yes, there are experts, and they have a very important voice. But I think one of the things that we at Yeshiva Chovei Torah try to do is really to empower the local rabbi who might have more expertise than a posek in the local flavor of the community. And I just think that, yes, Ma'asher lo patan, I'll have an idea that the Aruch HaShulchan says women can wear tefillin or individual women. You know, it's certainly not as valuable as some much greater mind, but I still have to voice my opinion, and you still have to understand that it might be that I think each and every one of us will have a perspective that the POSEC doesn't have, that the POSCHEME and the community has to keep in mind and becomes really part of the system of building halakha. So it is true there are experts, but at the same time, I think we have to make sure that we are empowered to speak up and also to empower the experts that we feel are making meaningful decisions.
Fully agree that it's important for us to bring those perspectives forward.
Okay, so I'd like to thank both of these gentlemen for their time and their energy and their passion. They came from quite a ways and gave freely of everything they had. So thank you very, very much. And thank you all for coming.